This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
These are not nightmares. It's happening. And it all leads back to here.
Welcome, everybody, to Cinematic Animalia, your weekly foray into the biology of movie monsters. Today, we are looking at Stranger Things Season 2, with a more in-depth look at the Upside Down, including why there's all that fucking dust everywhere all the time. Gross. And then we'll look at Season 3 as well, with some look at viruses jumping between species and what kin selection is. And then Libby will take us through writing from a child's perspective for adults. We'll go over some news first, tell you about the movie, our thoughts, and then get stuck into the biology. As always, the show will be broken up into those different segments. We'll have time codes below, so whatever season you are most interested in, you can skip ahead to it. But before we get into that, my name's Sam Perrin. I'm an invasive ecologist and climate data analyst based in Trondheim, Norway. I also run the website Ecology for the Masses, alongside Adam Harsick, a disease ecologist at the Ben-Gurion University of the Negev. And alongside Adam is the Baroness, Her Ladyship Libby Young, our story specialist and writer at Short Story Soup. Dave has been remodeling his house recently and has been displaying such frustration with the previous owner's handiwork that the energy built up inside of him and opened a portal into the Upside Down. So he's gone in there and done some real hands-on research for us. He'll be back next week. Maybe. We don't know.
The dwarves delved too greedily and too deep.
I am supremely hungover today. This is to do with news. I'm not just like, you know, I'm not 18 again bragging about how much I drank last night.
You sure?
Party.
That's what he was doing before with the recorder started, listeners.
No, because Australia finally had that big climate change election that we should have had 3 years ago. Not only did we vote in the less shit of the two big parties in Australia, we also voted in more Greens candidates. We voted in lots of independents who have placed climate change as their number one priority, stronger action on climate change. So, yeah, Australians finally took it seriously after, you know, half the country burning down 2 years ago. Yeah, that happened 2 years ago when we thought that was going to be the worst thing that happened in 2020.
For the American listeners that we have, when we think of independent, we think of a smaller third party that never really gets any votes because it doesn't matter. Can you give us explaining like I'm five for a quick rundown of the Aussie political parties and what this means for the country going forward?
Yeah, so in Australia, we don't vote for a president. We vote for our local candidate. And the party that gets the most seats in the House of Republicans, which I think you guys call it the House as well, right, in America?
House of Representatives for us.
Yeah, the House of which is equivalent to the House of Representatives in America. They govern, and whoever is elected to lead them by their own party, that becomes the Prime Minister. So independents an independent can't become Prime Minister of Australia, but they can quite easily, as we've seen from this last election, be elected as your local representative. If they, you know, if they campaign right, if they get around to enough people. The Greens ran huge grassroots campaigns in separate electorates, is what we call a voting district, is called an electorate in Australia. So we had a number of women who ran under the colour teal, but not associated with one party, called the Teal Independents, and almost all of them got in. This was not only in response to Australia's lack of action on climate change, but rising complaints of sexism from within the Liberal Party. They've been ignoring this for a long time, and all of a sudden, a bunch of women are now, you know, in the House of Representatives. So, yeah.
Excellent.
I said House of Republicans before, didn't I? Yeah, House of Representatives is what it should have been. Yeah.
I almost said something, but I was like, you know, maybe that's just what they call it.
Yeah, no, the House of Representatives, yeah. But yeah, so this is fantastic news. And now we just have to hope that now that we not only have a majority for the less shit of the two big parties in Australia, the Labor Party, but we have these influences from more climate change focused people, that we might actually be able to get something done over the next 3 years before the next election. So yeah, I'm really hopeful about the future of Australia. I think we actually do. I'm not very patriotic about Australia. The only two things I think are better than anywhere else in the world are the natural landscape and the voting system. It's one of the only places in the world where, in my opinion, it's almost impossible to waste your vote in any sense. So, yeah, I'm just... For once in my life, I'm hopeful.
And hungover.
And very hungover, yeah. Yes. Yeah. But more good news this week. There is a town in Germany called Waldorf.
Home of the Waldorf salad.
There is a species of bird there called the crested lark, which has been in sharp decline. Their populations have been in sharp decline in recent years, over the last decade or so. And to stop this from happening, to try and help the bird out, they have now banned cats from being allowed to roam outdoors. So if your cat is now found roaming outside, you face a 500 euro fine, which is, I think, I don't know,
$550 American.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is a big step forward. It's ruffled a lot of feathers. No, not the bloody lark feathers, am I right? Bloody human feathers.
They just get killed.
Yeah. But there have been, and I say this with quotation fingers, animal rights groups protesting this. Because, you know, they think it's mean to suddenly put these immense restrictions on cats that aren't used to staying inside. But, I mean, you know, now all of a sudden, these people just have to, shock and horror, spend time with their pets.
Yup.
Mm-hmm. Do their litter a little more.
Yeah, like any pet owner is supposed to.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think the thing that bothers me about why people are getting so upset that you didn't mention, Sam, is that it's just for breeding season. So this isn't going to be, like, for now and perpetuity forever. You know, it's just for these birds to be able to breed and raise their young to full, you know, adulthood. And people can't even sacrifice just a small window, you know, of their cat's time.
I mean, some of these animal rights groups have been saying that we're treating cats as second class. But, I mean, what?
Everybody knows cats don't have any class.
Yeah.
No, they don't. I'm currently watching our cat lick her own butthole.
So, exactly. Yeah.
And I just have to give this one quote by somebody who has missed the entire, like, scientific causes of this completely. It would be better to fight the actual causes than to blame cats for this.
Just point flying straight over their head like fucking Drax. Oh my god, I thought these dumb cat people were America exclusive, but of course, they're all over the planet.
They are.
And I mean, it's important. The crested larks are a really cool bird. We actually have them here in Israel, and it just looks like a little songbird with a mohawk, which is really fucking cool.
Great step forward. This needs to be normalized worldwide, if I'm honest. Like, absolutely. Okay, it's going to be hard to keep them in year-round, but breeding season, come on. I mean, it's a very small window.
Outdoor cats are a problem.
My bit of news this week is that National Geographic announced this week that Christian Cooper, if that name doesn't ring a bell, he is the bird watcher and black man who was the target of racism and false accusations in New York City Central Park in 2020, will be the host of a new TV series called Extraordinary Birder, in which he will take viewers, quote, into the wild, wonderful, and unpredictable world of birds.
That's so fucking cool.
Isn't it?
Good for him. It's a big turnaround, yeah.
It's always nice to see this kind of, see more representation in the more ecological or outdoor-related fields and industry, because from my interactions and conversations with people of color in academia and the outdoor world in general, it's something that is sadly lacking. So having this gentleman not only be falsely accused, which is awful, but then have it turn around and be able to get some representation and a show for him to pursue his passion is really fucking cool.
All right, since we are doing season 2 and 3, I decided this week to summarize into one poem for both seasons.
Ooh.
This is a haiku?
No.
Nancy's a cunt. The end.
The end.
11 is dumb. That's 5.
Yes. Yeah. Once again, Will needs fucking saving as his sanity slips and he starts raving. Demi dogs, mind flayers, and Billy the sex pot. These villains range from horrifying to hot. Hormones run rampant with Eleven and Mike, leaving Hopper feeling not so psyched. Still no one cares about Jonathan or Nancy, but new girls Robin and Max take everyone's fancy. Steve's still a hero, but so is a guy named Bob. He's back from Mordor, but leaves with a sob. There's a secret Russian lab underneath the mall, and U.S. military cover-ups to hide it all. Eleven gets emo, then loses her ability, ending with Joyce moving them away from Hawkins to find some tranquility.
Well done.
So, just for the listeners, I suggested, because I didn't get through season three, that we just focus on season two this episode, and Adam said, Libby's already written the season summary and she can't rewrite it. And I was just like, fucking hell, Libby, like, pull your finger out. It's just a summary. And now I very much understand why you could not rewrite it, yes.
Yeah.
What do we like about it, about seasons two and three?
I think for me, as always, of course, the pairing of Dustin and Steve in season two and it continuing through season three is wonderful. Steve and Robin in season three is, as I talked about last week, super fun. The effects are fantastic. I mean, this show has a really high budget, so it makes sense. But still, seeing it on Netflix versus a big budget Hollywood movie is nice, since I like seeing such high quality television. And Dacre Montgomery as Billy is such a fun villain. He's so crazy and charismatic and believable as like this beautiful psychopath who will just beat the shit out of you for existing.
And then go and hit on your mum with some of the smoothest goddamn lines you've ever seen in your life.
Have your mum melting in his hand like butter.
Oh my god. Yeah.
Absolutely. He definitely was my like as well. For me, I like all the new characters. Max, Robin, Bob. Like, I feel like everybody that they introduce is such a memorable and likable character.
Bob!
Yeah, and for me, Billy is obviously incredible. And what a storyline, like, for him as well. Not just like, oh, he's such a douche and, like, he's this, you know, insane sociopath. But, you know, the little bit of redemption at the end, too, is just, like, so moving.
It is, very much so.
As soon as you meet his father, you're just like, oh, okay. Yep.
Got it.
Cycle of abuse. Yeah. Yeah.
He's Australian, by the way. An amazing American accent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair, he did grow up with a Canadian mother. So, you know, I don't know if...
Boo. That is a Canada, I think we can all say, is this podcast's least favorite country. Right, Dave?
Yeah. Yeah, so I echo exactly what Adam said about Dustin and Steve. Great pairing. Another great pairing is Mike and Will. Put the two whiniest fucking characters in one room so I can just tune out for entire scenes and not have to worry about either of them. The introduction of Lucas's little sister, Erica. My God. Every fucking scene she was in, she was killing it. Yeah. I got a code for you. Code shut your face. Yes!
Got him.
And look,
she's so good.
I often think that lines about, oh, bloody women are never wrong. You can never win an argument against a woman. I hate that sort of shit. But that moment in season two where Lucas is asking his dad, what do you do when mum's mad at you? But what if she's wrong? And he just stares at his son and says, she's never wrong, son. That bored me. I thought it was hilarious. Yeah, Lucas and Max are so much more interesting than Mike and Eleven. And Robin and Steve, again, just those two are perfect. I mean, and Billy is obviously like what they were thinking of doing with Steve in the first season before Joe Keery rocked up and just blew everybody's socks off with a smile and a
hair flip.
What didn't we like?
You touched on your likes. Mike and Will are just so much of a bore wine fest that it's just not interesting.
Oh.
Of course, it goes without saying that Jonathan and Nancy are a charisma vacuum. I couldn't care less. The whole sequence in 2 with Eleven going to Chicago and meeting the other experimented kids, like, this is a weird filler episode that doesn't need to happen. We don't really... I think my understanding is that was supposed to be the foundation for a spin-off series with these other experimental children.
Backdoor pilot, yeah.
Backdoor pilot, yes, thank you. I couldn't care less. It's not interesting. I forget about it if it comes up in my mind. Like, let's just not include it because the season misses nothing without it.
It kills the momentum of the show dead.
I think we talked about that in whatever episode we did that I talked about backdoor pilots. And when you're writing them, that's why you have to be so careful in how you're presenting this new material. Because like you guys just said, it can stop a show dead in its tracks. And that was for sure my dislike as well. The whole 11 going emo is just so fucking trite and boring.
Yeah. Bitchin'.
Unoriginal, and yeah, I just could care fucking less. I also still don't care about Jonathan and Nancy. Like, I can't understand why they're still characters. And then also I feel like they, in season three especially, really shafted Dustin and Lucas more, because the romance of Mike and Eleven was such a fixation. And I just felt like they didn't give those two characters enough. Like, I was trying to incorporate them in the poem for the summary, and like, I couldn't really add anything because like, nothing's really happened with their characters too much.
Dustin has a girlfriend, though.
That's true.
And she does exist.
And she reads Ursula Le Guin. Yeah. Nancy, not so much, but Jonathan, it felt like they just had no idea what to do with him this time around. Mike also felt like they kind of, he was just kind of feels like he's hanging around for a lot of it. I don't think they knew what to do with him either. That Chicago filler episode, I skipped it completely when I was doing my season two rewatch, and it did not hurt a thing. It made the show run really nicely. 8 episodes again. That scene when Hopper is just screaming at 11 in season two. Yeah, you're bad at this, dude. Like, you were a father beforehand. You don't even have the excuse of, like, navigating something. You had a daughter. You are a bad father, and you should not be talking to a kid that way. Like, I know she's got mind powers, and you might be a bit scared, but still.
I know you're a guy in the 80s, a white male in the 80s who grew up in the 60s and 70s. So there's a certain level of emotional detachment and lack of understanding of emotions is expected. But even for that baseline, like, come on, dude.
You were a substandard dad.
Do we have trivias?
So Billy, the actor's name is Dacre Montgomery, had previously filmed Power Rangers, and as a result was absolutely shredded for the role. So when he got this job, he purposely, like, toned down or fattened up for his character of Billy because he felt like that's not how men looked or wanted to look like in the 80s. So he purposefully lost his 8-pack.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the dude's obviously still in amazing shape, but I'm just like, it's not...
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it's not Marvel movie ripped, which I assume he was for the Power Rangers. Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
Related to Dacre Montgomery at the pool, in season three, in that episode where he actually comes out for the whole lifeguard sequence as all the moms eagerly awaiting the young man coming out of the lighthouse changing station shirtless and getting up, and they're all, you know, showing off, trying to present themselves very nicely. The song that's playing when he enters the pool for that scene is Moving in Stereo by The Cars, which is the same song that was playing when Phoebe Cates emerged from the pool in Fast Times at Ridgemont High from 1982.
Oh, right.
Very notorious scene.
Yeah.
And in that same episode, Dusty actually mentioned his long-distance girlfriend is, quote, hotter than Phoebe Cates.
I thought this was interesting just because I love Little Women. but both Winona Ryder and Maya Hawke, who plays Robin, have each played the character of Jo March in different productions of Little Women.
The Duffer Brothers, who direct and I think write a lot of this show as well, are huge Stephen King fans, and they actually wanted to direct the reboot of It from, you know, the mid to late 2010s. But they didn't get the job, so instead, they do Stranger Things and throw in a lot of Stephen King references and homages. So, Steve Harrington in the show is referred to as King Steve when he's in high school because of his good looks, athleticism, blah, 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 which is, of course, a reference to Stephen King. King Steve, Steve King, Stephen King. In the morgue, the state trooper that is guarding the morgue itself in, I don't remember which episode it was, but he can be seen reading Cujo. Speaking of Cujo, the series logo itself, the very iconic red font, is actually the same font that was used for the covers of the original 1980s editions of Stephen King's novels, like Cujo and Christine.
It's Stephen King. It's Halloween. If you just give him a Clark bar and say, have a nice evening, it's somehow gone awry. Do you know what I mean?
I hate Halloween.
So, before we get stuck into the science today, if you've got any thoughts or questions, as always, you can find Adam and I on Twitter. I'm at Big Dr. Fishboy. Adam is at Hasik Adam. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can visit the website cinematicaanimalia.com or email us at cinematica.animalia@gmail.com. You can also chat or game with us on Discord. You can find the link to the server in the episode description or on the website. If you want to read Libby's work, you can visit shortstorysoup.substack.com and read a ravenous pack of short stories ready to tear your throat out. And if you want to hear about some of the more hardcore science that Adam and I write about, you can check out Ecology for the Masses for articles by us and by a massive team of international writers. I'd especially recommend checking out a recent article called The Rogue Shark Theory, or The Guilt of One Shark, which was by a guy called Ben Bluck, who we will possibly be interviewing when we look at Shark Week and Jaws later this year.
Speaking of Rogue Shark and Jaws, I remembered a bit of trivium. The police uniforms worn by the police department, Hopper specifically, in Hawkins, are a direct copy-paste from Jaws, the police department, nice. From the people in that coastal town.
And lastly, if you do enjoy the podcast, please recommend it to a friend. Tell your mates about it. And it'd also be great if you could jump into whatever podcast app you're using and give us a quick 5-star rating. Thank you to the new ratings we got this week, by the way.
Thank you.
Okay, so we touched on the Demogorgon a lot last week. So, you know, go back and listen to that episode if you want to hear more about the Demogorgon. But there are the...
Some would say it was the sole focus.
Yes. But there are demigods. But we have the Demodogs this week, as Dustin explains to anyone. It's like Demogorgon and dogs. It's like a compound word. We talked last week about the fact that we think these things could be attaching themselves, like grabbing onto larger prey and ripping chunks out. Whether or not they're actually taking down the prey or killing them on the spot, we didn't kind of know. But this week, we see a much more kind of logical mode of feeding. Both mode of movement and mode of feeding, I think, with the Demodogs. We see a big pack of them taking several people down, just ripping chunks out.
Shredding people, murdering, left, right, and center.
Being quadrupedal. And we also see that they are good climbers here. So the shoulder joints that we see kind of make a bit of sense.
Which is interesting for a quadruped. There aren't really too many examples of that in the animal kingdom beyond it. Animals can move with either the bipedal or the quadrupedal motion, and some of them switch between the two, like the lemurs do. They'll either a little hop on their back feet, but then they'll also walk on all fours. But seeing that mode of transportation for an organism that is more built like a canine and then able to climb using a shoulder joint is pretty cool, very unique.
Yeah. And we also do see them to use their claws to rip at people and grab onto people. Poor old Bob gets a fucking...
Bob.
Oh, fucking Sean Astin, the most likable character in this fucking show, is just brutally torn to pieces in front of everyone's eyes.
Yeah, there's that zoom out shot of him as you see them, like, really ripping into him. And he's just dying in pain, still not really understanding what the fuck is happening.
Reminiscent of everyone's favorite character from Attack the Block, Hi-Hat, getting murdered by the gorilla wolf motherfuckers.
The pack hunting tactics make total sense, although they do split up a lot as well, the Demodogs. It's unclear as to whether they would behave like this normally, or they're behaving like this because they're being told what to do by the Mind Slayer. I mean, you can train dogs to attack, of course.
The coordination is exceptional, especially from any lack of real connection that we can see. Usually packs that operate like this are within sight of one another, or hearing, or even just in the exact close proximity. Like African wild dogs, one of the most successful predators on the planet, do these coursing attacks with one another. They're not on different savannas hunting completely different animals. So
yeah,
it's unclear how they do it beyond the interdimensional Wi-Fi that the mind player seems to use via the portal.
Yeah.
No relation to the hyenas. These are the so-called wild dogs of Africa.
Yeah, moving on from the Demodogs, one of the foremost aspects of season two is the fact that there's these weird fucking tentacled vines that constantly keep growing out from the breach between dimensions. And of course, Hopper gets caught up in a little foray of Stranger Things into some tentacle hentai later on in the season.
He does.
There's nothing that grows this fast, of course.
Not even bamboo.
Yeah, I think Dave had a section on some of the fastest growing plants in the world. But what they do to Hopper is reminiscent of what a lot of creepers or lianas or vines kind of do to trees, I should say. What they're doing, like the concept of like wrapping around something to form structure, to give them structure and to reach upwards to the light. Obviously, that's not what they're doing here. They're not reaching up to light. Light is a big problem here. How does photosynthesis work in this world? You do have species of plants that work like this, that will twist around something to get further up in the canopy, and can choke something to death. So strangler figs are a group of figs within the genus Ficus. They start off their life as epiphytes. So epiphytes are things that attach to larger organisms and grow off them. So they will burst out from a place somewhere along a tree. They'll start their life as epiphytes, but they will grow upwards as well as growing downwards, and then they will eventually root in the soil and no longer be epiphytes. One of the interesting things about strangler figs is that their roots often fuse as they travel downwards, and sometimes this is going to even lead to the fig encasing the entire tree. So they're not actual parasites. They don't steal anything from the tree in terms of vitamins, nutrients. But as they go up and encircle the tree in many cases, they can completely cut off a tree from the sunlight and kill them by just kind of starving them to death, of, you know, ridding them of their ability to photosynthesize. So in extreme cases, you can have entire figs that have grown, entire strangler figs that have grown around these trees, and the tree itself dies and then just rots, and you have just the fig structure left, which is insanely cool. These all happen in rainforest, by the way. I really want to be able to see one of these one day.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah, same.
And look, they sound like a problem, like a bad thing, but they're not. They're a big driver of biodiversity in rainforests. By killing off these trees, they provide nutrients. The rotting tree provides important nutrients in what, contrary to might seem logical, a very nutrient poor part of the world. Rainforest soils are very, very nutrient poor. By suppressing certain trees, they create more biodiversity in the canopy. So they're really important. But they're not very fast growing. They're not exactly slow growers, but they're not as fast growing as what we see here. But an example of something that is not as fast growing, but very fast growing, is kudzu, which Adam and Libby will be familiar with as North Americans.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we call it kudzu.
Kudzu.
Yeah, okay. Kudzu. It's also known as Mile a Minute and the Vine That Ate the South.
Yeah.
Yes.
So kudzu is obviously, it's not native in the US. It's originally from East Asia, Japan, Korea, I believe. And Eastern
Japan China and well. South China. Yeah.
It's called a mile a minute for a reason. It doesn't quite grow a mile a minute, but it can grow up to, I think, a foot a day was the estimate I saw.
Mm-hmm.
Which is absurd. Like, that's 30 centimeters a day. That's a meter. That's 2 meters a week. And images of just entire fields, forests, man-made structures covered with this thing.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
The vines can get up to like over 100 feet long.
And it just keeps fucking growing. Yeah.
About 30 meters.
Yeah. It's come to Europe now. It's very isolated areas. Ooh. It is not spreading as fast as it did in the US. I think it got into the US in like the 1930s.
It did.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll put an image of kudzu in the Cinematica Discord, so those of you who don't know what it is can look at it.
It's one of those things that, having grown up mostly in Alabama in my childhood, and it's kudzu is, of course, all over Alabama because it's in the middle of the South, I've been so acclimated to it and desensitized to it, it's really thinking back of like, oh, we have this one plant taking over entire parts of the countryside. I was just like, oh, that's kudzu. It's always been there. But then knowing it's invasive and seeing the damage is so surreal that I don't think I can still truly grasp it, because I've been so desensitized to it growing up my entire life with it.
Yeah. And as with most invasive species, if you don't get it out when it first appears, it's really hard to remove. Because like we've said, it just grows so fast. You can set goats, cattle on it, but that's only going to do so much. You have to weed extensively as soon as it pops up.
Yeah.
The cool part about kudzu too is that the leaves, flowers, and roots can all be eaten. So if you're out weeding some kudzu, you can make a little use of it.
Neither of them are growing this fast, but the kind of the spread that we see initially of, you know, them having to burn every 1 or 2 days. Yeah, absolutely. There is precedent for this sort of thing. It's just a little exaggerated. That's all.
Yeah. Bamboo can grow a meter a day, which is 4 centimeters per hour. Which is insane to think about. You could watch a plant literally grow. So speed that up a little bit, and you got these vines.
Oh, good Lord, it's everywhere!
Okay, and then the other question about the botany, I guess? No, hang on. What is it? Mycology? When we're talking about fungus?
About fungus? Mycology.
So botany or mycology of the upside down. is the thing that's getting me really pissed off every time I have to look at the Upside Down is just those enormous dust motes that are constantly fucking floating around. It irritates me so much to have to look at that shit all the time. I mean, I know, you know, the Upside Down is supposed to be unsettling, but that is incredibly unsettling to me. Always seeing those constant just little white things everywhere in the air.
I think that might be because of your sensitivity to a pollen hay fever allergy.
That is possible. And
it's just your worst nightmare.
Yeah, and I did look up how big pollen can get. So the biggest that pollen can get to is about a fifth of a millimeter. So I think this is probably a little too large to be pollen. But there is just an interesting scene where Hopper gets some, what looks like, I don't know, some kind of fungus fruiting body that kind of sprays this dusty looking stuff all over him.
It jizzes in his face,
yeah.
Yeah, it popped off, if you will.
Always it.
But there are a couple of species of mushroom which do shoot their spores out really, really violently. So it led me to the conclusion that maybe these could be mushroom spores. So there's the fungal shotgun, Pylobolus, which is a rapidly growing fungus, usually grows in people's shit. Well, not people's shit, anybody's shit. Anybody's shit. Any organism's shit. We got there in the end.
Literal fecal matter.
Yeah. It's got a lens-like vesicle at its base, which can pick up light, and light triggers the ejaculation, basically. So you have pressure which builds up inside the structure until it gets to about 100 pounds per square inch, which might not sound like a lot, but for the inside of a fungus, it's quite a lot.
The fuck ton.
That vesicle I was talking about then explodes, and the spores can get to about 2 meters away, which is pretty much what we see here. So not the actual ejection of the spores, not ridiculous at all. And then there is also Spherobolus or Spherobolus, I have no idea, which is called the sphere thrower of the artillery fungus. Again, usually grows in shit. This one again is triggered by light. It can expel the spores at about 6 meters, generally in the direction of the light. So what Hopper does, shining a torch on something and it then, you know, ejecting spores at him, jizzing all over his face. Yeah, totally probable. The only thing about this that is not in line with these sort of fungus is, with these sort of fungi, is that they are very much not fun. is that the spores aren't sticking to anything. The spores usually stick to things. They're quite, you know, mucousy, and they will stick to whatever. That's not what happens in this case at all. We just kind of see it floating around. Whilst I think these are potentially fungal fruiting bodies that are shooting their spores out, I don't think that's what all the drifting stuff is. So my last theory that I was kind of grasping at was the fact that it is consistent with just a constant ash shower. So, I mean, potentially the Upside Down is so desolate because we've recently had a massive meteor strike in that dimension. Doesn't explain why it's in the tunnels under Hawkins, but still. They do believe that after the meteor that wiped out the dinosaurs hit, for a long time we would have had, and these are the words of Doug Robertson from the University of Colorado, dust and soot from the impact and fires would have created an impact winter with zero sunlight reaching the surface of the Earth for a year or so, which is very consistent with what we see in the Upside Down. So yeah, potentially something like that's happened. Yeah, and that's why you've got no life on that side at all. Doesn't explain why it's a weird facsimile of Hawkins, but...
No, not so much. Or, yeah, that's a weird nightmare version with dust everywhere, but it's still unsettling.
The only big problem with the media theory, I mean, apart from most things about it, is that what we actually see as a result of this layer of ash is called the KPG boundary, which was a kind of a thin layer of soot that coincided with this ash winter that you can see in rock formations. Yeah, so geologists call it, like I said, the KPG boundary, and you find it all around the world. We're not really seeing much of an ash buildup in the Upside Down, so all this stuff is constantly floating around, but never landing?
It could be, I mean, to go really far into the wacky science fiction of the show, this dimension of time could work differently, and this could still very well be early in the nuclear winter, or this wintry cloud part of this time period, because the Demogorgons are still existing, and if it's much further on in this period, most of the life that would have been around before this meteor strike would be dead not too long after it, because they're not adapted to these new conditions. That's why you have these massive die-offs and a burst of evolution afterwards.
Yeah. Could also be that there's just a cleaning crew in the Upside Down that we never see. Just come around and give it a good vacuum once a day. Yeah.
That seems more likely.
Yeah.
Part of season two is Will's seeming infection by the Mind Flayer, this tornado spider beast that is the apparent supreme ruler of the Upside Down. And this goes more in season three when you see other people become infected by the Mind Flayer itself and start to do its bidding. And this kind of thing, a Dr. Owens, played by...
Paul Reiser.
Paul Reiser, thank you. Speaking of the aliens connection.
Yeah.
Paul Reiser mentions that it might be some kind of virus controlling everybody and working in concert, which doesn't really work. And we'll talk about that for a couple different reasons. But I wanted to ask you two, living through, and as some people would say, on the other side of the COVID pandemic, what do you know about viruses jumping species?
A little bit, just based on research post-COVID. So I know that it doesn't happen very often, but it can be a huge problem. And a lot of the time there's intermediate species as well. Like, there was obviously the whole theory that we didn't get COVID directly from bats. We got it from another species. I believe the main theory was supposed to be a pangolin at the start.
A pangolin, yeah.
Yeah. And I know that it happens, it's a lot more likely to happen when animals are stressed. And as we encroach on their territory and come into contact with stressed animals more often, that's more likely to happen as well. Which is why, and I know we've said this before, I'll say it once more, this COVID pandemic was predicted 10 years ago.
I know that now COVID is, quote, over and we have monkeypox. Is monkeypox where little monkeys shoot out of your skin, Adam?
I fucking hope not, because that's horrifying. But in season three, we see this virus has apparently, or the Mind Flayer at least, and it's the vector of the Mind Flayer, or pieces of the Mind Flayer, transmitting what is potentially a virus to rats and humans, and I'm assuming the Demodogs, because it's also controlling them somehow. This is possible, but realistically it's not really going to happen, because there are a plethora of very specific steps that have to happen in the right order and all at the right time, in the right place, with the right organisms, for a virus to jump from one species to another. I know that it might not sound very believable when I say that this doesn't happen that often. When we have COVID, we had swine flu really bad in 2009. There's been hoof and mouth, or the encephalitis problem from mad cow disease. There has been another bird flu, other swine flus. These things do happen.
Monkeypox,
which is monkeypox from another primate?
It's common in animals such as rats, mice, and rabbits, and the African squirrel. That was first identified in laboratory monkeys.
So, we have monkeypox as well. Hantavirus is another problem with rodents, especially for people that work with rodents. It's a very big danger. You have to be careful when you don't get hantavirus. These things don't tend to happen that often, because there's not only a ton of viruses, but all these things have to happen in the right order. Namely, an animal infected with a given virus has to come in contact with humans. That animal, step two, has to be shedding the virus. So, one of the issues with testing for COVID early on in an infection is they might not be able to pick up the virus in your system. So even though you have it, they can't tell you, because there's not enough of it multiplying within you. And at that point, you're likely not going to be contagious. So you're not shedding the virus. You're not transmitting it to other new hosts. This virus that is shed from an infected animal that has come in contact with a human has to then enter the human cells. This, from my understanding, is usually the big stopgap that prevents these things from happening. Viruses are adapted to infect a very specific set of organisms, and they do this we talked about this a little bit before, but for a little bit more detail and a bit of a refresher, you have a lock and key type mechanism with the receptors on your cells. A virus will use its key adaptation to open the lock to get inside the cell. A lot of the viruses that are specific to a lot of different species have keys that are meant for that specific species, quote, doors, and it will not work on a human door. If a virus happens to have an adaptation that works for a human, that is when it can then enter a human cell and that human will get sick. So the next step has to be the virus itself, after getting in the human cell, has to be able to replicate within the human. So you can get in there, but then it might not be able to replicate and it just stops. Nothing happens. But if it can then replicate and get to the next step, be able to spread from that human to other humans and also be able to infect them, That is when you have these viruses jumping species. Now, we talked about the danger with hantaviruses because this is something that does happen and people do get really sick, and there are a lot of hantavirus species that can infect humans, including a researcher who unfortunately died not too long ago from being bitten or coming in contact with hantavirus from the rodents that she was working on. But you also have these things not work. In my own experience now in the lab I work in, I work with gerbils, which are rodents, and Bartonella, a group of bacteria that infect these rodents. And there are there's a ton of different strains and species that infect the rodents, but although there are Bartonella that can infect humans, the ones that infect the rodents that I work with do not infect humans, thankfully. Because sometimes, when you're working with systems like this, accidents happen, and you will get exposed. I was exposed to Bartonella. I likely have remnants of Bartonella in my system still, but thankfully, because it is a gerbil-specific Bartonella, it did not jump species, and I am not sick with Bartonella. So
you've heard it here. Adam is the source for gerbil fox.
gerbil flu, please. But yeah, these things can happen, and they unfortunately do happen. See COVID, I think you've heard of it. But it is not very common, and this big flesh monster mind flayer spreading to rats, then immediately to humans. Although these things do happen, see the plague. It's not really going to be the most likely and efficient way for this to happen within Hawkins, Indiana.
Okay. So you're saying that when viruses jump species, that it's really just a phage?
It's not bad. It's not bad at all. It's also accurate.
To jump to add on to what Adam is saying, you know, we did list seemingly a lot of viruses that have jump species, but do either of you know how many individual viruses exist on the planet Earth? Individual viruses.
It's beyond trillions.
An estimated 10 nonillion, which is 10 to the 31st power, individual viruses exist on our planet. That is enough to assign one to every single star in the universe 100 million times over.
In defense of viruses.
Oh, big virus sponsoring Sam this week.
Viruses have contributed to a lot of evolution of life on Earth. The transmission of genes between, two virus cells and then onto other organisms is a huge source of horizontal gene transfer, which is one way that genes can develop in organisms. I'm not well versed on this, but I would really highly recommend reading an article called Viruses and Their Influence on Marine Life on Ecology for the Masses by Lara Beckman. Lara's a marine biologist who knows this sort of stuff inside out and does fantastic work illustrating as well. So definitely check out that article.
Give mine a big virus, of course. That's your weekly weekly reminder. But yeah, we see these viruses infect a lot of different organisms and potentially even the demodogs in season 2. But it results in everything working together to fulfill a common purpose. We see it with the rats all coming to the warehouse where poor Billy gets trapped in a very horrific scene. You know, he's an asshole, but you still have to feel bad for that guy getting drugged to his imminent doom. It infects other people who then work together in the hospital as weird zombie body snatcher, invasion of the body snatcher type dynamics. And this either implies some form of cooperation, much like the demodogs have, or a mind control interdimensional Wi-Fi type thing. Now, because we're trying to make this more realistic to what you would see in the real world, I am going to maintain that this is a case of kin selection. A lot of people talk about how, quote, nice animals are, they're helping each other. You'll see a video growing on the internet of, oh, look, it was so cool, this animal did this for this other animal. Animals are not nice. The natural world is hard, and you're not going to survive if you're being nice and giving away your time, energy, and resources to other animals that will take it, use it, and for their own success. The closest thing you have to this, or some form of altruism in the natural world, is what's called kin selection. And this is where an organism will help its sibling and or its, quote, nieces and nephews with getting more fit and kind of growing in life. This only works because somewhat close relatives of those animals share part of that animal's genetic code. So by helping that animal, it is still helping to kind of propagate its own genetic code further down the line, even if it's not its own offspring. So by this, because this happens, this animal is selected to help its kin, therefore kin selection. And we're applying this to the viruses and this quote virus that we're calling the mind flayer and its effects on the people of Hawkins. So if this is a potential one of the many patron organisms of the pod, a super organism, kind of like a hive type structure where the Mind Flayer is a queen equivalent in a eusocial structure. And its infective stages are clones or very close relatives of it. And well, if all the offspring are identical to one another, if they help the other viruses infect other people who have not been exposed yet, they are helping to propagate not only their own genetic line, but the genetic line of their sister, brother, drones, whatever you want to call them, because they would all be sharing a very similar genetic code. So by working together in this coordinated fashion, they are still following a biological imperative to reproduce and further their own genetic line. So
yeah,
it's not mind control. It's not Wi-Fi. It's, I mean, it might be a mind control on the part of this, if it is a virus, taking over the host, but they work together to try to infect other people because it makes things better for their own genes. That's the success of their own genes, making them more fit.
Okay. Something that we haven't talked about for that I want to ask in relation to Joyce Byers's Joyce Byers question in season two, what happens when there's none of my son left? What does happen to a host when a virus has, you know, taken up every square inch of the body that it can?
It likely dies. You see this with cells, and for these, as Libby's point earlier about phage, phage are viruses that infect either bacteria or other single cell or very small organisms. And what they do is insert themselves into that host. They use all of its structures to make more of themselves, and it gets to the point where they literally burst the cell because they come pouring out of it. Okay. If you think about the xenomorph and alien popping out of a host's chest, it's that, but there's 50 of them. They're all coming out at the same time because there's no space left. So
okay.
The host tends to die in that kind of case.
Oh, good Lord, it's everywhere!
So I kind of wanted to talk today about writing from a child's perspective for adults. Obviously, when you're writing a kid's book, it's different because you're writing for kids. This is writing from the point of view of a child. As a human adult yourself.
Should you write an orgy with six kids in a sewer?
Stephen King, hell no. absolutely not.
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
Yeah.
Good Lord. So we've bitched a lot in this podcast about child acting. But I also want to propose that the writing is also as much to blame for that. Because bad writing, as we know, can lead to cringy moments in general. But when you're writing poorly as a child, and even when a child actor is delivering those lines, you can tell. You can tell it's from an adult. You can tell that it's not something a child would do or say or act. And I wanted to bring this up because I feel like, for the most part, there are a few moments that don't cut it for me. But for the most part, I feel like Stranger Things does this really well. All of the characters, you know, behave like 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds as we see them growing up. And I feel like the dialogue that they deliver is very much as a child. And I think they did a good job with that. I wanted to sort of talk about, if you're writing it as a child, what do you do? Obviously, we're not children anymore. We might think that we can remember, like, how we felt or what we did, but sometimes it's not easy to remember how we thought. So the first thing is just spend time with children.
Thank you.
And particularly the age group that you want to write them from. This could be nieces, nephews, cousins, you know, your own kids if you want.
Don't tell me to spend time with my child.
I said if you want.
Oh, if I want. Okay, good. I've got an out then, yeah.
You don't have to. Remember, Sam, you're free to make your own choices.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, when you're trying to write from any sort of perspective, immersion can really help. You know, being around that can give you that insight to how they might think or act or talk. Kids develop at a crazy rate. So a 2-year-old walks, talks, and acts differently from a 5-year-old. A 5-year-old acts differently from a 7-year-old, so on and so forth. So don't lump kids into one category. Their dialogue and vocabulary changes. It's ever expanding. Their brains are understanding things differently. So for example,
look no further than the cast of Stranger Things. They've all aged so fucking quickly. mm-hmm. even from within seasons where they're supposed to be a year older. You're not a year older, and this is not just a 26-year-old playing an 18-year-old in high school, Twin Peaks. But, I mean, it got so bad that the actor playing Dustin, his voice had changed so much by the end of production that they couldn't use him for voiceovers anymore because his voice was literally different.
Do you two fellas know when kids start to understand sarcasm? Like, what age?
My guess would be 12.
No.
Let's let the man who has a child answer.
I don't know children.
I taught my son how to lie when he was 5. Mm-hmm. And I think he got sarcasm when he was about 7.
Yeah, so...
But it had to be very, very overt sarcasm initially.
Exactly. So yeah, so 6 to 7 is when they start understanding sarcasm. However, they don't begin to understand the humor of sarcasm until they're about 8 years old. So like even within that genre, like there's differences in the level of comprehension.
You sure it's not when they're 12?
No, it's not.
We were riding home once in the car with both my parents were there as well. And I was joking with my son, you know, throwing back and forth the usual sort of insults we use, like, you know, you're a poopy head, well, you're a butt face. And then all of a sudden he kicked it up an extra level and said, yeah, well, mummy doesn't love you anymore.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
Got him.
And then that was my go-to of whenever I was like, this is what sarcasm is. You remember when you said that? That was sarcasm, right? And he's like, yes.
Sure.
Of course it was. Your son got back to his exactly. room and just like wiped his sweaty brow away like, oh, he fell for it. Whew.
Good save. Yeah.
That's a great example because he didn't understand it. He just said that of like, no, she doesn't. But then they start to understand the nuance of conversation. Yeah, so keep in mind that they'll have different goals in life. There is a home video of me when I'm about 4 to 5 years old saying that my favorite food was green beans and I wanted to, quote, do puzzles as a living when I grew up. But by the time I was 8, I hated every green food and wanted to be a vet. So make sure you're understanding your age demographic and that there will be differences in like what they, you know, hope or want for their life. And there will be consistencies with kids from a formation standpoint.
If you know Libby, knowing that as a child she wanted to do puzzles for a living will not surprise you in the least.
This is one of the things that I forgot to mention in my likes for this week. Dustin bossing his mum around like that, like just constantly giving fucking orders to everybody. Like when he sees Steve out the front as well, 20 seconds later, he's like, you, right, in the car with me, let's go, you're coming with me. And Steve's just like, okay, I guess I'm working for this kid now?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. You're my boss now?
Kind of diving back in, keep in mind that kids at kind of any age don't really have a whole lot of life experience to draw on. You know, kids are actually pretty aware that they don't know a lot of things. When I was a kid, I remember playing Trivial Pursuit with my dad, and he would answer every question, and I looked at him, and I was just like, how the fuck do you know all this? Like, it just blew me away. I thought he was just like the smartest person in the world. But on the flip side of that, they really take pride in the things that they do know. So if you've ever hung around kids, they're so proud to be like, do you know that, you know, viruses have these things called phages? You know, like they use those things that they know for certain that they've learned. And they're very, very proud of that knowledge because they understand, you know, somewhat subconsciously that there is so much that they don't understand. And it's a way for them to participate in the world and show value and show individualism. But this also extends to figurative language, idioms, and associations. So, for example, a kid would never describe the color red as wine-colored, typically because unless they're a, you know, 7-year-old lush, they don't have that association with wine.
Or French.
Yeah.
They might, however, say Robitussin red from all their traumatic experiences with cherry cough syrup, or that just might be me.
The best.
As an adult, we might say lit up like a switchboard because we understand that idiom. We understand that reference of what a switchboard is. But a kid, however, might not have that type of historical knowledge yet. So the association idiom they would use would be lit up like a Christmas tree, you know, something that they're familiar with. So keep in mind when you're writing that kind of stuff to think about what age they are and what they would know at that point.
Are you telling me, Libby, that these damn kids these days don't know nothing?
They never did.
They never did. Much like Adam, kids' brains run on full steam. Especially younger children, they don't have the mental acuity to formulate conversational direction, so the result is a stream of consciousness and seemingly distracted or hyperactive conversation. So they might be talking about a new toy commercial that they saw, and then they'll start talking about how they learned all the words to a particular song. To them, it makes sense because this is where their brain is taking them, but they have very loose concepts of social contracts. So like how small talk is supposed to go, or when to stop talking, Adam, or if you were like me, when to start talking. Kids' brains are wired towards magical thinking, not logical. I think this is partially because there is so much as kids that is yet to be explained. So we fill in the blanks with magical thinking. And we kind of still do that as adults. Think about like auras or astrology or conspiracy theories. You know, there's things that we take that we don't know and explain it with supernatural. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but kids do that to like the umpteenth, right? Because there's so much that they don't know. And also, I think it's because so many things are brand new. It is magical. Like the wonderment is very real. So make sure you're keeping that language and state of mind when writing as a kid, that the world is full of vast, whimsical secrets.
Fish and whimsy.
And then finally, the kid or kids that you write still are characters, right? So keep in mind that they are individuals. Like we all had individual goals, hopes, likes, dislikes, senses of humor, complexity. Stay away from stereotypes. I was a shy kid, right? So if you're writing a shy kid, you kind of start to fill in blanks with all the things that a shy kid would do. So I was petrified of speaking with strangers. But with my friends and family, I could be loud. I could be goofy. I was physical. Like I liked wrestling with my sister and my dad. You know, that's not something that you normally would attribute to a shy kid. So I think keep in mind that as humans, we are diverse and kids are humans too. They're diverse too. So have substance, direction, have past parental influences, and realized humanness to the kid or kids that you're writing. But basically, bottom line is read Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton and fucking don't do that.
Do the opposite.
Yeah. If you think they were annoying in the movie, my God, it's an order of magnitude worse.
You have seen nothing yet.
I have never screamed reading a book before, and not from horror.
Because they're frustrating at times in the movie, but because of the characters. But in the book, it is like, my God, why do you think this is how a kid works?
Absolutely. I felt like it made me question if Michael Crichton was lab grown, like did he have a childhood, because I don't understand how someone can be so far away from how kids think or understand the world.
Yeah. His mother died giving birth to a 25-year-old.
So, exactly. You know. Do you guys feel that they did a good job writing kids for Stranger Things?
For sure. I think much going off what I said last week of I always use this as the benchmark for what successful child acting looks like, and I think a lot of that then a lot of that credit should go to the writing for these characters as well, because although these actors are talented, I don't really think they're going to be bringing a lot to that role beyond being able to embody a character that has been written already.
It's hard for me to say, because I mean, I may give the impression that I, you know, I really enjoy time around kids because I have my own, but that's not the case at all. I relate very well to my own kid, I feel, but as soon as like one of his friends comes in the room, I'm just like, oh fuck, another one. More than one, I can't deal with this. So I don't really know. It's hard for me to say. I think so. None of them strike me as overt stereotypes at all,
yeah.
Which I think is good.
I think for me, the only complaint that I have is the season 2 11 going emo storyline. Oh. And I felt like that was adults writing kids and men writing girls, because it was like her version of puberty. And it was just very cringy and not well written. You know, I felt like they did rely heavily on stereotypes for that storyline. And it did not feel like she was herself, like her own character.
You'll look even more badass.
Bitchin'.
Yeah, bitchin'.
Do we feel bad for any of the monsters we see here? The Demodogs, Dart himself, the Mind Flayer, any of the creepy crawly tentacles. Is there anything we feel particularly bad for?
No, not really. They're animals living their animal life, we think. And beyond lab experimentation that seems to be happening with the Demogorgon, especially with the after credits of season 3, I don't really feel a particularly draw or sympathy for them.
If this is a virus that's infecting them, that is making them behave in a certain way, which would, you know, make sense, it's why they're so hyper-aggressive as opposed to just taking down what they need, then I do feel bad for the Demodogs, if that's the case. But I don't think it is, so...
I agree with Sam.
Yeah. On that very particular proviso, we feel sort of bad for them.
Yes. Maybe conditionally bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What? Okay, here's a good one. Because I think we're all going to recommend this. We would all recommend this, right? Seasons 2 and 3. Yeah. Of the three seasons, how would you rank them?
Ooh. That's a really good question. I feel like...
1, 3, 2.
1, 3, 2. I think I'd probably agree with that. I think at the time, season 1 was just such a... For me, a breath of fresh air for a... Because I had not... Until that... About that time, I wasn't really watching series. I was just more of a movie person. And seeing, in my opinion, a very high-quality show with likable characters, very impressive, especially for children, acting, and a fun world with an interesting mystery to it, it really did a lot for me. Season 2 was nice to see more of that world, and Sean Astin's portrayal of Bob was incredible. And the setting, Halloween setting, just gave me more of that nice nostalgia vibe. But yeah, I think Season 3, like Libby said, was the best with the... The stakes being raised, the fun character interactions, the cool monster effects, and where this world seems to be going. Hmm. Minus the Chicago episode.
I'm going to rank everything based purely on the amount of Steve Harrington and Erica we get. So I'm going to go 3, 2, 1.
Yes.
Good choice.
Just roasting the fuck out of everybody. That little girl is like, my God.
She's brutal.
She is ruthless. Like, when Lucas has got his proton pack on, and she's just like, nerd. You and your friends are nerds. Nerds. God damn.
As a kid who's already figured out exactly who she is at a very young age. Supreme confidence.
Don't you love your country?
You can't spell America without Erica.
Next week, we're going to be looking at Carnosaur. It's a interesting, some would say, knockoff of Jurassic Park that somehow came out before Jurassic Park was released, both the movie and the book. So I'm very intrigued to watch this B-movie schlock that Sam has been picketing for so long. But join us for that next week. And remember, the monsters aren't real, but the science is.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Don't you think it's weird how we only seem to hang out when the world's about to end?